Hi everyone and welcome to today's webinar on police powers and your rights. My name is Catherine Bowden and I'm the Communication and Community Legal Education Officer here at Legal Aid Queensland. I'd just like to start today by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today and pay our respects to Elders past, present and emerging. Today's information is for community legal education purposes only. I'm just going to go over a few housekeeping slides and then I'll hand you over to today's presenter, Nicholas Hanley. So the webinar is being recorded today. It'll be published on our YouTube channel. So you can find that on our Information for Community Workers and Carers page, which sits on Legal Aid Queensland's website. That'll be up in the coming months. If everyone can just raise their hand, just to make sure that you can hear us and you can see our webcam and everything's working. Just raise your hands now for me if everything's okay. Thank you. I can see a few raised. Okay, you're welcome to pop those back down. If you are having any technical issues, the number to call is on the screen there. It's 1-800-136-402. Now you should all see something that looks like this on your screen on the right hand side toolbar. You'll mostly be listening in with your mic and speakers. We have muted you today, so please just keep that on mute. And you'll be able to ask questions today by typing into the questions bar. So you can see this in the toolbar as well. If you pull out questions, type those in there. We're asking you to hold those until the end, and Nicholas and I will let you know when we're calling for questions. Please don't mention any clients' names. Just ask general and useful questions. Think about things that might benefit everyone in the webinar rather than specific client issues. And you can take a moment to download the PowerPoint today. That'll be a useful resource for you. So again, that's in the right-hand side toolbar. Just expand the handout section out and click on the PowerPoint. You can download that anytime throughout the webinar. All right, we're going to start out with a poll. So we're interested to know, what area do you work in? Some of you will be from Southeast Queensland, some from Far North, regional, and I know we've got a few of you linking in from outside of Queensland today. So Nicholas will be letting you know when the law is actually relevant to you today. Looks like we have about 75% from Southeast Queensland so far, so that's pretty great. We've got a few from Far North and again regional Queensland as well. So I'll just let that run for a few more seconds, just to get everyone's results in. Okay, thank you for participating in that. I'll share the results with you. You might be interested to know that 69% of you are from Southeast Queensland, and then we've got a few from regional and third to that, Far North Queensland, and a few from outside of Queensland. So again, it's a Queensland jurisdiction and Nicholas will let you know when the law is relevant to you today. All right, I've just got one more question for you. How would you rate your knowledge of Legal Aid Queensland? Do you feel like you know a lot about Legal Aid and you've got a high knowledge of it? Probably worked with us a lot, or you've got a good knowledge, there's still a lot more you'd like to learn. Some of you will have limited knowledge, which is why you're here today, which is great. And actually, we've got quite a few of you with no knowledge of Legal Aid, so hopefully you'll learn a lot about us today and you'll be able to use our services in the future. But the majority of you have a limited knowledge, so I'm sure everyone will learn a lot today. Share those results with you now so you can see. Half of you have limited, 34% good. and 9% no knowledge of legal aid, Queensland. Okay, I'd like to now introduce you to Nicholas Hanley. He's a lawyer in our criminal law services team. He'll be taking you through the law for police powers and what your client's rights are.
Thank you, Catherine. So to start off with, can I just say that what I'm discussing today, the majority of it relates to Queensland specifically. There are some things which are generalised advice, and I'll let you know when it's generalised, but for those 3% who are outside of Queensland, the majority of it relates to Queensland-specific law. The topics that I'll be going over today and covering in some depth will be talking with police, arrests, and during arrests what police can and cannot do. When it comes to warrants, are warrants needed for vehicles, persons and properties in situations involving warrants? Making a complaint to a police person, so that's when you're a victim or a witness, and then also making a complaint about a police person, and lastly, what legal aid can do in those situations to help. So we're going to run a poll, and we're just going to ask you to fill out who are your clients. Are they young people, 18 to 25 years, people who are homeless, people with disability, ATSLs, people, or general community. So we'll see what we've got coming in. So it looks like at the moment there's the majority of your clients in general community, but there are a number of young persons, and there is an equal spread across homeless and people with disability, and a small percentage, it looks like, who are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. So the majority are general community. So we'll close that poll now. We'll share the results so you can see what your fellow attendees are dealing with. Okay. So the advice I'm giving is useful for everyone, really. There are specific advices that are specific to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, but again, I'll outline when that is the case. The first topic that I'll discuss is talking with police. People talk with police in everyday situations. It doesn't necessarily have to be to do with crime or anything else. Sometimes you might just be looking for directions. Police are there to serve and protect. That's one of their mottos. They pride themselves on being able to be approachable and being able to assist people in the community. When it comes to talking with police, that's one of the things that you should realise. They are there to help you, and therefore their role is to be very approachable. So when discussing things with police, it really should be just like having a conversation with anyone else. The most important thing to remember is that the police are human. So when I say that, it means that if you were speaking to someone in the street, you would speak to them and you'd be courteous and you'd be respectful to them, and it's the same with police. So if you're asking for directions, you ask politely. If you're asking for assistance in relation to something that you believe you've witnessed, then again, be polite and say, well, this is what I've just witnessed. Can you give me some assistance? And if you are reporting a crime and you're the victim of a crime, again, it's all about respect. The majority of people that we work with in legal aid, and it would appear as though the majority of people that your organisations represent may be in a situation where they are being spoken to by police in relation to an alleged offence or in assistance for another offence. The best advice I can give is to use all those things that I've just spoken about in relation to speaking to police in a general form when it comes to speaking to police in relation to their involvement with you. You must be polite. If you're not polite with police, then generally you'll find yourself on the end of a charge of either public nuisance or contravene direction. You don't have to speak with police when it comes to any criminal offences. I'll be covering that soon. But when you do interact, it's just important to understand that they have the power in those situations to charge you with a number of offences. So when they do speak with you, just be careful about how you respond in kind. The best advice that I can give to my clients, who are often coming in as duty lawyer clients, so that's a duty lawyer client is someone who turns up to court and they don't have a lawyer and they see me on the morning of and they'll say, I don't understand why I'm here and why I've been charged. It may be an offence such as public nuisance because they were raising their voice and telling the police to go away. In those instances, I say, if you had have just assisted the police by answering what you were doing on the train station, and the answer was you were catching a train, and you didn't respond angrily and get upset because they were targeting you, then you would have found that you probably wouldn't have been here in the first place. So it's a matter of always keeping a level head and also being cool in the situation. Talking with police has another side to it, and that is that you're right to silence. So when police do speak to you, then you must understand that if it is in relation to a criminal offence or an alleged criminal offence, you don't have to speak to them at all. The only things that you generally must tell a police officer are your name and address. So there are a lot of people who find themselves answering questions to try and be helpful with police, but the problem is that generally is being recorded and it will generally be used against you in some way or another. Police are required to give you your rights if they are questioning you formally, but if they're questioning you informally, oftentimes they'll have their recorder going and you may inadvertently say something that's going to get yourself into trouble. So the advice that I can give to you to give to any persons that you are assisting is that if they believe that they are under some kind of investigation, alternatively police are trying to find out that they've done something wrong, the simple answer is to give them your name and address and then just say, I really don't wish to speak to you any further without either a lawyer present or without a support person present. But through all of this, the main point is police are human, so speak to them in a way that you would like to be spoken to yourself, even if they aren't speaking to you in that way, and realise that level heads prevail. And at the end of the day, if you remain calm, it can only do good things for you. So we're going to do a poll again, and this is how often do your clients talk to you about interactions with the police? And the answers that you can choose are every day, every week, occasionally and rarely. This will give us an idea of whether or not your clientele are dealing with police regularly and how useful this seminar is going to be, of course. So we've got the results coming in. We've got a majority is occasionally, with over 50%. There are about a quarter, 25% of every week, very few every day, and there is about one-fifth who are rarely speaking with police. So it's good that you're obviously the right audience to be presenting this webinar to, because the majority of your clients are either every week or occasionally dealing with police. So we'll publish those results now, and the poll has just been shared. Throughout this, I'm going to obviously try and add some humour into it, and this is just something I got off the internet, which I won't leave up there for too long, but there are certainly things that you shouldn't be saying to police officers, and this is just a funny list of those things not to say. You can muse over that after this webinar is finished. So we're moving on to the more nitty-gritty stuff, which is obviously what I specialise in, and that's arrests, what police can and cannot do. And these are some of the questions that I'll be covering. I'll also be covering some other questions that I haven't put on this list. The first one is, do I have to answer questions? So this backs up from what I was discussing before in relation to speaking with police. The simple answer is you don't have to answer any questions beyond what your name and address is. So oftentimes police will come up to you and they speak to you in a very friendly way, and they'll ask you a series of questions, and without you even knowing it, you could be answering things which, as I said before, could incriminate you. So when it comes to answering questions, the simple answer is you do not have to answer anything other than your name and address. If police press you, oftentimes people feel uncomfortable and they don't know what to say. As I said previously, with your clientele, it's best to just let them know that in a polite way, they can just say, I've given you my name and address and I don't wish to answer any further questions. I will need a lawyer present or I'll need a support person present if I am going to answer any questions. Police have to respect that and they're not allowed to pursue questioning. Unfortunately, there is a small number of police who will continue to ask questions and suggest to you that it's okay, we're not going to get you in trouble, we just want you to help us out. And if you help us out, then you know that's going to be a really good thing. People feel pressured and they feel, oh, well, he's being very nice, so I might start answering questions. In those situations, generally, you can't undo it, so don't feel too bad for yourself. And if you were dealing with your clientele, don't make them feel bad for doing that. But just give them that advice that in the future they really shouldn't do that. An example of how it can work against you is one of my jobs is to represent people who are in custody in court. It's called in custody duty lawyer. And part of that role is I read them out the charges that they have received from police. And then I advise them their options, which are on that particular day to apply for bail or not to apply for bail. And the number of clients I have who are shocked when I say police are objecting to your getting bail. And they will say to me, but the police told me if I answered their questions, then they wouldn't object to me getting bail. So they're not technically allowed to do that. It's called an inducement, but there are ways in which police will suggest that if you help them, then you know they have no problems with you, but it'll all be used against you because the police's job is to find and catch criminals. So their primary purpose is to solve offences. So that is what you can and cannot do in relation to answering questions. And you can see the second question there is what questions do I have to answer? And there's only one, which is your name and address. Can you be searched is one of the next questions that I'll answer. You can be searched. It's the circumstances under which that occurs. Generally, police can only search your person if they believe that there is either a drug or a weapon on you or evidence of some other crime. Ordinarily, police would need some form of warrant, but I'll get into that later. But when it comes to searching, they can search you. What to do in those situations is very important because if they do find something on your client, then that isn't the end of the story because if it's deemed that that search is unlawful, then we're in a situation as lawyers where we can argue that that is the case and that evidence shouldn't be used against you. My general advice to anyone when it comes to searches by police on their person is to always say no. Even if you think that you've got nothing to hide, always say no. That doesn't mean they won't continue to search you, but it means that you have placed it on the record, which is their microphone, because they're always recording, that you don't consent to it. They will then proceed to, if they think that they have what's called reasonable suspicion, to search you. The term reasonable suspicion is very important because, again, I don't want to get too much into the legal side of it, but that is what they use to search a person. They've got to have reasonable suspicion. There is a definition for that. In a nutshell, it breaks down to what a reasonable person would believe in the circumstances. So, for example, if police come up to someone on the street and they speak to that person and that person has glassy eyes, smells of cannabis, and they have a suspicion that they may have cannabis on them, you would ordinarily find that was a reasonable suspicion because all of those indicia were present, so they had the glassy eyes and the smell of cannabis. But an example where it would not be reasonable is if I was walking down the street today and police came up and said, I wish to search you, I think we've got drugs on you. There's nothing about my presentation, hopefully, that would give them that impression. And so the role in that situation would be for me to say I don't consent. That is the other issue when it comes to searches, is that if you do consent, it doesn't matter how unlawful their suspicion is, once you have consented, then lawyers can't argue that that evidence be thrown away. So there are a lot of decisions in the court which have said that if you consent, then lawyers have no right to argue against anything that's found on you. So again, the advice that I give to you to give to your clientele is that they should always say, I don't wish to be searched. Even if they think they're helping, they should say that I don't wish to be searched. like I said, if a search occurs, leave it to the lawyers later on. In relation to arrests and questioning back at the station or out in the field, the question often arises is if the person needs a support person there. Children under the age of 17, so 17 and under, it's about to be changed in Queensland to 18, so 17-year-olds will be considered children again. They are required to have a support person present. So if police are questioning any child, it is the police's obligation to have a support person there. Other people who may wish to have support people are people who have intellectual disabilities or people who have some kind of mental disability or mental infirmity. Police must give you your rights as to whether or not you are allowed to have a support person there. Generally speaking, without going into all the different nuances, when police are about to question you, they must give you your rights, that is the right to remain silent. You always have the right to have a lawyer present, and in certain circumstances, you have the right to have a support person present. One of the questions which came through prior to this, and we'll be taking questions at the end, but specifically relating to this, was people who require interpreters and or people who are deaf. It's police's obligation to always ensure that you are able to understand any questions and the process that's at hand. So if you are deaf, police cannot just wing it and ask you questions. They would be required to have an Auslan interpreter there. Similarly, if you are from a different country and your clientele don't understand English properly, it is their obligation to make sure that there is an interpreter there. They can suspend any questioning for a reasonable amount of time to have those people present. But if during that time they cannot get someone present, then the questioning will need to occur on a different day. In relation to arrests, as a bit of a joke, I put the last one in, can I run? I put that in there because it's amazing how many people think that's the best idea to do. They're scared. They think something bad's about to happen. But in running and or not stopping, then you're committing an offence of obstruct police. So even though their initial investigation might not lead anywhere, I'll certainly charge you with leaving them. Another little internet sensation. So we're going to run another poll now. So under a search warrant, a police officer may enter your client's house and open locked cupboards in the relevant area. So we haven't covered search warrants yet, but I'd like to have an idea of what you think before we talk about search warrants. So an overwhelming number of people are writing in saying that this is true. So it looks like we're sitting at about a little above 85%, 88% for true, 13% false. The answer is, of course, true. We'll publish the results, and I'll deal with warrants specifically when we move on to the next topic. So when it comes to searches and warrants, generally there are three situations where this is relevant. You've got searches of vehicles, searches of person, and searches of property. I'm going to go through each of them one by one to give you an idea of the situation that's involved, and I'll start with a vehicle. So again, do you have to consent to a search of your vehicle? The answer is no. You never have to consent to anything when it comes to police. If you do not wish them to search your vehicle, then your simple answer to the police officer should be, no, I do not wish to consent. At this point, they may decline to search your vehicle, and they may decline to get a search, and they may decide to go and get a search warrant, or they may proceed with the search. What is a warrant? A warrant is a piece of paper which is generally issued by a magistrate or a justice of the peace, which allows police to search a particular place in relation to finding something. So if you don't agree with the warrant, then there's not much you can do about it at that point. That's why there are lawyers involved. You can express the fact that you disagree, and you can tell the police officers that I don't agree with what's in this warrant. I don't want you to search my property. I don't want you to search my vehicle. However, if they then do that, just like when I was saying, when you're speaking with police, your objection is noted, and then the lawyer has the ability to assist you later on. If you are the subject of a search warrant, then you must get a copy. And that copy is given to you and explained to you. It's called a notice to occupy, and that explains why they're there, the reason that they have the ability to search, and what they have to search for. The last one is what if police don't have a warrant. And again, that ties in with what I was discussing before for reasonable suspicion. And if they don't have a warrant, then there are circumstances where they can. So we'll start with the vehicle. So a general situation might be this, that a police officer pulls someone up and they do a license check on that person in the vehicle, and then they decide that they wish to search the car. They say to the vehicle owner, we wish to search your car. The vehicle owner says, I do not consent to searching my vehicle. And then police say, well, we're going to do it anyway. That's an example in those strict terms that that's not a lawful search, because there's nothing there that suggests that there's any form of reasonable suspicion of any offences occurring. The offences must be drugs or drug-related offences, weapons offences, or any offences that carry a maximum of 7 years or more in jail. Now, in this situation, which I'm about to give you, you'll see the difference and why it is that police would have a reasonable suspicion. And this is based on a case that I had recently where police come upon a car in the middle of the valley, in the middle of the night. As they come up behind the car, they notice the glowing of a light in the front of the car. When they approach closer to the car, they see smoke coming out of the car, but it doesn't have an odour. It was an odourless smell. As they get to the car, they speak to the driver and the occupant on the other side, two police officers. They ask them what they were doing. They both said they were waiting for a friend. They couldn't give the name of the friend or where he was coming from. Police noticed that they had very glassy eyes and their jaws were moving a lot and they were sweating profusely. And then one of the officers noticed in the front seat, in the footwell, was a clip seal bag. Oftentimes, obviously, clip seal bags are used to contain drugs. So police advised the driver and the passenger that they had formed a reasonable suspicion that they had drug or drug-related paraphernalia in the car and they wished to search the vehicle. Now, my client declined to consent to search and said, I don't want you to search the vehicle. Police said, well, we have a reasonable suspicion, so we're going to. Now, when my client first came to me, he asked whether or not there was anything we could do about the search, in which they found some drugs and a smoking utensil, as well as those clip seal bags. And I said, in this situation, there's nothing we can do about what they found because they have every right to search your vehicle in that instance because they formed a reasonable suspicion. So an ordinary member of public coming up and seeing someone in that situation may very well form the same view that there is something dodgy going on in the car. A different scenario is where there was, and this is a case as opposed to something which I personally had, it's what's called an authority, was a case where police were aware that there was a vehicle outside a courtroom, and when they went to the courtroom, they saw the person inside the court. They knew that he had a history of drug use. When they went back outside and followed him to his car, they saw that inside the vehicle there was what they believed to be drugs. They then arrested him because he had drugs on his person, and after he was taken into the police station, they then went and searched his vehicle. The one thing which I haven't mentioned yet is that the other reason why police are able to search your vehicle without a warrant are in instances where it would be difficult to get a warrant in that instance, and there is a real risk that if they don't search the vehicle, that the evidence might be destroyed. So in that situation that I gave you when someone was in their car in the street, if police didn't search that vehicle straight away, then there's every chance that because no offence has been committed as of yet, they can drive off. This instance, where the gentleman had already been arrested, all of a sudden police had him in custody, his car wasn't going anywhere, and they made the decision to search the vehicle and they found 500 grams of cocaine. His lawyers argued successfully that in that instance, it wasn't lawful to search, even though they had a reasonable suspicion, because they were able to get a search warrant very easily at the courtroom they just left, and there was no chance of that evidence being destroyed or removed. So they're the two types of searches of a vehicle, one with a warrant, one without a warrant. Breaking it down simply, do police believe that there is an offence that's been committed? Are they in a position where they can delay the search and get a search warrant? If they are not able to delay it, they can search your vehicle. If they can delay it, that is, they can somehow detain you under a different arrest warrant, then they'll need to get a warrant from a court. In relations to persons, it's almost identical. So there is no such thing as a warrant for a person. You can't get a search warrant for a person. You can have an arrest warrant for a person. An arrest warrant is where police have already established that you have committed an offence and they're trying to find you to physically arrest you. So that's simply a piece of paper which says, again, from a magistrate of justice of the peace, that upon police finding this person, you can be arrested. That's very simple. But there is no such thing as a warrant to search a person. So everything I've discussed with the vehicle applies when it comes to persons as well. Police need to have a reasonable suspicion. That suspicion needs to be based on evidence they are able to actually outline. So the example I gave you at the beginning, someone who has glassy eyes, smells of cannabis, people have been able to search that person. When it comes to searching of a person, it doesn't mean that they have the right in the street to take all of your clothes off. It means they have a right to ask you to outturn your pockets. It means they have the right to do what's called a frisk search, which is lightly rubbing their hands on the outsides of your clothing to see whether or not there are any items. They are able to search anything that is on your person, so that means that if you've got a bag, they can search through the bag. And if they find anything that they believe is evidence of that offence that they think that you're committing, they're able to keep that until the investigation continues. My advice remains the same. You do not have to consent to a person search. If you do consent, then it's very difficult for lawyers to argue against it. But if you don't consent and a lawyer is able to find out whether or not there is reasonable suspicion or a lack thereof, then it makes it a lot easier for someone at Legal Aid or another organisation to assist your clientele in trying to make sure that an injustice has not been done. What has occurred most recently, which is a change, is when it comes to mobile phones and also when it comes to computers. Now, this is really, really important when it comes to searches of persons and vehicles, and that is because police do have the right to seize a mobile phone in circumstances where they have a reasonable suspicion. I keep on going back to that word. But they don't have a right to ask you to give the code to them unless they have a specific warrant. So even if they've formed a reasonable suspicion that you have drugs in your car or on your person, they've exercised their right lawfully to search you without a warrant, and they say, we are going to take your phone. They do not have the right to then ask you to give them the passcode without a warrant. So if they wish to get into your phone, then they will need to get a specific warrant to get you to give them the passcode. This is very important for this reason. Oftentimes police search phones, and what they will find is harmless text messages between a person and someone else trying to arrange for the purchase or sale of some drugs, cannabis or something like that, and what may or may not have started out as a simple offence of possessing a small amount of cannabis or other drug can turn into a much larger investigation. I have a lot of young persons who come to me and I will read the facts of what they've been charged with, and it'll be that they've been charged with possessing, for example, 6 or 7 ecstasy tablets. And during the facts, it will reveal that they had their phone taken by police and that police got the warrant and got the numbers to get into the phone. And I often say to them, have you ever sold any ecstasy tablets? And they'll say, we've sold a couple to a couple of friends. And I say, well, don't be surprised if you get charged with trafficking. Trafficking is obviously the offence of carrying on a business. Broken down simply, if I were to sell drugs to five of my close friends over a period of time, that is a business. I sell something, I get something in return. The number of young clients that I've had over the years who have no criminal history, are otherwise generally very good people, have fallen into drug use recreationally and didn't think there was anything wrong with selling to friends, find themselves before the Supreme Court looking at some serious jail time for that. So when it comes to phones, that is something which you should be telling anyone who you work with, that regardless of what police say, unless there is a warrant, they just do not ever give across that passcode. When it comes to the searching of property, and by property I mean a dwelling, because houses are their own different place to search, again, similar principles apply. If police believe that they have a reasonable suspicion that there is an offence occurring in the house, then they can search it without a warrant. Given that houses aren't able to be moved as easily as vehicles, unless you've got a house that's sitting on the back of a trailer, police generally will not search a house without a warrant. There are very few circumstances where police will conduct a search without a warrant on a house, because it is obvious to see that if they have that much concern, then they can go and get a warrant. Circumstances where they may not have time to get a warrant is if they believe that there are small amounts of drugs and they think they can be flushed down the toilet. So in those situations, police may be able to come in. When they are within a vehicle, when they are within a house, they are not allowed, as opposed to person, where they can search your entire person, and vehicle, where they can search your entire vehicle, they are not allowed to search the entire house. If they come in and they have a reasonable suspicion of an offence, they are required to search only the area where they believe that offence is occurring. When it comes to a search warrant, as was the question before, can they search inside locked cupboards? They can search anywhere that is stipulated on the warrant or is related to the offence which is stipulated on the warrant. As an example, it might simply say, police have reasonable suspicion that there is cannabis growing in this house in the basement, and evidence of cannabis being cut up and sealed in the kitchen. We therefore are going to search for these things. So that wouldn't give them the right necessarily to go up and start searching through drawers in your bedroom, because the warrant outlines that they're looking for the basement and the kitchen. So warrants need to be specific and police need to follow those. I think I've covered everything pretty well when it comes to warrants and vehicles, persons and properties, but obviously if you have any questions at the end, then you can shoot them through. I'll move on now to making a complaint to police. So this is in an instance where you would obviously be a victim yourself, or alternatively you've witnessed something. Then in these instances, this is what you essentially would need to do. What I've written down here is actually taken from the police website, so the Queensland Police Government website, and that website will be shown later on. I've got some links to that, and you'll be able to get it when you download the slides. You essentially need to try and include these things: what happened, when it happened, where it happened, who said what to whom, whether anyone else saw what happened other than yourself, and details of any documents, records, video footage. People often have phone footage that they take these days that may help police. And if you are specifically the victim yourself, then evidence of any injury or loss that can be demonstrated to police. The reason why you need so much detail is because if, for example, and I'll use the example of a criminal offence, if you are the victim of a criminal offence, if one of your clientele is the victim of a criminal offence, or an offence that they believe to be a criminal offence, then police are going to need as much detail as possible to try and do the best they can for the person. So I'll give you an example of what would be a bad way of making a complaint to police and what would be a helpful way. So let's say an 18-year-old male who is one of your clientele is assaulted. he goes up to a police officer and says, "Mr. Officer, I've just been assaulted." And the police officer says, "Where did this occur? Give me as much detail." He said, "Oh, well, it was sort of over there a little bit, and I don't really remember who was around, but oh, I think there was a guy. He may have been 6 foot, or he could have been 4 foot. I'm not quite sure. He had medium brown, red hair. I don't know where he ran off to, and I think he gave me this bruise, but that could be from yesterday." Police are going to find it very difficult to follow up on that because there's not enough detail to follow up on that. If they happened to find someone to match that description and they make any form of charge and or arrest, it's then going to be very easy for a defence lawyer like myself to pick that apart and say, well, the evidence isn't clear, so how can you be sure that it's that person? However, if you go to police and you give them as much detail as possible, it makes it very difficult for a defence lawyer to pick apart, and it makes it very easy for someone to have justice done because police are able to investigate properly. So the 18-year-old boy again comes across to police and says, "Mr. Officer, I've just been assaulted by a male on the corner of 1st and 2nd Street. It occurred at approximately 10:30 a.m. When I was there, there were four witnesses. This is what they looked like. Afterwards, I managed to get their names, so if you'd like to speak to them, these are the injuries that I've just had occur to me. Split lip, this wasn't there before this. I was just standing there speaking to this guy, never been before. All of a sudden, he asked for a cigarette. He said his name was Tom, but I don't know his last name. When I said no, he punched me out of the blue and ran off." That's enough for police to start a very good investigation and do the best to help you. So when it comes to clientele making complaints to police, the best thing to do is to ensure that as much detail is given, which gives police the best ability to go and investigate. As much detail as can be given also means as much accurate detail as can be given. So it's very important that your clients understand that, again, it's the role of a defence lawyer, that we will look at credibility and reliability of people, and so we'll be looking as to whether or not they're telling the truth. So you may think that you're telling the truth, and you may be telling police some details, but if it's not exactly what occurred and later on your story changes a little bit, then we might find a situation where police are going to not be able to do their job as best as they can. And be careful when you are speaking to police and making a complaint that you don't get yourself into trouble. A quick example of that is a fellow that I represented once who had some money stolen off him, and so he went and made a complaint to police and said, "I had some money stolen off me," and then police said, "What happened?" He said, "Well, I went down the road to buy a 50 bag of cannabis, and then the guy took my money." So he was in a little bit of trouble himself. Making a complaint about the police, again, it's the same situation as before, as much detail as possible as necessary. I'm not going to repeat what I've already been through because detail is the key. In these situations, you can either make a complaint to Legal Aid Queensland, who can help you with making a complaint formally. Formal complaints to police are done through three avenues. One is to the police themselves, one is to the ethical standards, and one is to the CCC. Complaints to police are generally minor complaints. They handle them internally. They will investigate and they will come back to you with a report. Complaints to the ethical standards are generally ones that are more serious. Perhaps when you're arrested there was a bit too much violence involved, or a bit too much physical violence involved in restraining you. Complaints to CCC are generally really big complaints of corruption or bribery done by police. Either way, when you make the complaint, then as much detail as possible is required for police to do a thorough investigation of all those other two external bodies. Once you've lodged the complaint, police make sure that your confidentiality is protected, your complaint is managed objectively, and all of those other items there. The idea is to make sure that police maintain their reputation. Those are the three websites that deal with complaints. That's the police website, ethical standards, and the CCC. Legal aid is obviously where I work, and these are the services that we provide. I won't read through them. These are only a small part of them. But in a nutshell, we assist people with legal issues, legal information, representation, ensuring that you have your day in court and that you have justice done properly and that you have the right to representation. And also you have access to information and access to everything you need to know to make sure that there is not injustice done against you. So what we're going to do now is we're going to open up to some questions, and Catherine's going to join us again, and we'll answer as many questions as we can. If I can't answer the questions, then I'll let you know, and I'll let you know why.
Okay, thanks, Nicholas, and I'd just like to thank you for your great presentation today as well. I'm sure that everyone's learned a lot and continue to learn during question time now. So if you haven't already, just type your questions into the questions box and Nicholas will go through any relevant questions. Just a reminder, don't mention clients' names, keep everything confidential, and ask relevant questions that you think other attendees will be able to benefit from as well. All right, so first one here we have, Nicholas, is before police search you, do they have to tell you what offence they have reasonable suspicion of you committing? Can they just have reasonable suspicion of any crime?
That's a really good question, Madeline. It can't just be any crime. It has to be a specific crime which is within the definition in the Police Powers and Responsibilities Act. I won't go into what they are, but there are specific crimes. The big ones are drug-related crimes and weapon-related crimes. In answer to the first part of the question, they are supposed to tell you what they have suspicion of. If they don't tell you, though, that doesn't mean that the search is unlawful. But they are supposed to tell you what they have suspicion of.
Thanks, Nicholas. We'll go to question number two. We've got workers' duty of care to report offence to police. What is the worker's duty of care to report an offence to police? For example, if a client has been suspended of their driver's licence, but they continue to drive to the service to get support.
Lynn, that's a good question. The answer is that you don't have any obligation. The only time that you have an obligation to report anything to police is if that you become aware of imminent harm to the person themselves or someone else. So if someone comes in and says, I'm going to commit suicide right now, or I'm going to walk outside and kill someone, that is the only instance that you have any duty of care to go to police. If someone comes into you and says, I've got, you know, 3 ecstasy tablets in my bag, you have no obligation to tell police.
Okay, on that topic of obligations to investigate or pursue by police, what kinds of inquiries do the police have an obligation to actually investigate?
If someone makes a complaint to police that is of a criminal offence, then they have an obligation to make inquiries into that, no matter what it is, providing they believe that there is evidence to support it. So if someone comes in, like I said before, and doesn't give police enough information about an offence that occurred on a date somewhere to someone, then they will not investigate it. But if you come in and make a genuine complaint, they must investigate that complaint and they must show you evidence of that.
Thanks for all your questions, guys. Please keep them coming through. We've got a couple more that Nicholas can answer, so if you've got a burning question, send it through now. And so, Nicholas, in a criminal situation that also involves domestic violence, how important is keeping a diary record?
Darlene, great question, because it doesn't just apply to domestic violence, it applies to other things. Keeping a diary is absolutely essential if you want police to be able to do the best investigation. It's called contemporaneous notes. So if when police go to charge someone, then they can say that on this date at this time you did this, then that gives more weight to the allegation, because oftentimes what lawyers like myself will do, and it's only because it's part of our job, but if someone doesn't complain about something for 3 years, then we can say, well, why didn't you make note of it at the time? Why didn't you complain? But if there's a diary, then that's fantastic. So really, really good in any situation.
Thanks, Nicholas. And you mentioned earlier that people do have the right to an interpreter. So do you know how the police actually go about finding an interpreter for minority communities?
Yes, I do. And again, Darlene, that's Kelly. Kelly, good question. Interpreters must be ordered through an accredited interpreter site. So there is only one office that does accredited interpretation, or sorry, interpreting. So police must go through that. They go through a court-approved interpreting service.
And on that note, if you would actually like to email us, you can use the webinar's email address. So it's webinars, webinars at legalaid.qld.gov.au. So if you want to send through an email there. And that goes for any other questions you have that you may or may not feel comfortable asking us here today. If you have further questions, you're welcome to use that address and we'll answer what we can. I will go on to what the eligibility criteria is for legal aid.
Obviously, I can only speak about the criminal matters, but eligibility for legal aid is that you've been charged with an offence. This is to get a grant of aid. So a grant of aid is actually when you have someone who is representing you and they have a file, as opposed to duty lawyer. So I'll start with the duty lawyer. Duty lawyer, you come to court, you're charged with a criminal offence, and you don't have a lawyer. There is no eligibility at all, a duty lawyer will see you. To get a file and a grant of aid, you must be charged with a criminal offence. There must be a risk of you going to jail, or alternatively, you must have a defence to that. So, for example, if you're charged with a public nuisance, and that public nuisance and you've got no criminal history involves you urinating in the street, and you want a lawyer to work with you and defend that, legal aid will not represent you because, unless you have a defence that it wasn't you, because you're not at risk of going to jail. So come to the Legal Aid website. It talks about eligibility. It talks about what is a grant of aid and how to get one. So again, that's the best way to get that information.
Thanks for that. We'll go back to the question on translating and interpreting service.
TIS is the organisation through whom police will arrange interpreters. They will ring up and they will explain what the dialect is, and they'll ask for someone to be made available to come and help. Police generally will use that over a friend, because the problem is with friends, they may not be relaying everything. An interpreter's job is to relay everything verbatim from police to an alleged offender and then return. So there's no way that there's lost in communication occurring.
Thank you. Are we able to go back to the question for a minute about keeping a diary?
Yes.
More specifically, when you're looking at a criminal case that's linked with domestic violence, do you know how the police actually investigate the situation?
When it comes to domestic violence?
Yeah.
Yes. So if someone makes a complaint about domestic violence, police will generally sit you down and they'll ask you to detail what the domestic violence is. Now, domestic violence has a very broad definition. It may actually be acts of violence, but it can be intimidatory behaviour as well. They will then ask for specific incidents. They will always ask for specific incidents. And if you then have your diary, for example, you can say, well, I happen to have a diary which I keep every day, and I've made note of these events. Police will then take a copy of that diary. They will then use that in their investigation. They'll generally call the offender in for questioning. The offender hopefully will not answer any questions. But obviously, that's from a defence lawyer's point of view. If they do answer questions, they will put to them those allegations. Now, when it comes to the actual court proceedings, as I said, it will be very difficult to argue against those events occurring if someone has kept a diary, because there's no reason why they would have written those on those days 2 years ago, and so it strengthens what's called the credibility and reliability of that person. So police will use that diary literally as evidence of what occurred.
Thank you. We'll go into a bit more detail about some serious criminal offences. So, for instance, in the case of attempted murder, when a legal aid lawyer such as yourself would be sitting in with a suspect who's been questioning by police for attempted murder, what is the cut-off for a serious offence such as rape?
There's no real cut-off in so far as generally a legal aid lawyer will only come and help assist you at a police station if we've got a file for you. We don't have the services such that we can just go down to a police station with someone who has only just been charged with an offence. We do have the ability to give you phone advice, and the phone advice will be the same across the board. And no matter what your offence is, be it murder, attempted murder, rape, assaults, drugs, down to very small offences, summary offences, public nuisance, urinating, our advice will be always do not give an interview. So that is our standard advice. We do not condone interviews under any circumstances whatsoever, because there are just too many ways that an interview can be used against you. There are a lot of people who think, but I've done nothing wrong, I want to help clear my name. The simple answer is, if you've done nothing wrong, there'll be no evidence of it. But if you happen to have a legal aid file and you know that you're about to be charged with a further offence, then yes, you can arrange for a police, for a legal aid person to come to a watch house with you for the purpose of being charged. And there is no cut-off for that. So we can assist you in being charged. We'll literally sit there and advise you not to answer questions. You'll be charged and then you'll be released.
And Nicholas, what about if the client has any mental health issues? What extra precautions do police take then?
Police need to make sure that a person is able to understand the process of what's occurring. So if you have an intellectual disability or you have a mental health disability, you're suffering from psychosis, schizophrenia, they need to make sure that you're aware at the time of what's going on. They will essentially apply the same test that we do as lawyers when it comes to mental health. It's called the Presser test. It's a case which involved a fellow called Presser. Essentially, that you understand the nature of the charge, so you understand what you're being charged with, you understand the procedures that are occurring, you understand the police's role, you understand your right to silence, you understand what will eventually happen insofar as you understand what a prosecutor is, what a defence lawyer is, what a judge is. They will make that very brief assessment, and if they believe that you are essentially cognizant or you understand what's going on, they will proceed. If you have severe disabilities, mental health-wise or anything else, then they will have an obligation to make sure that you have a support person there, or they just discontinue questioning.
And what if they don't take all of those precautions and the police use racial slurs and they're quite aggressive towards the clients? Can you remind us again, how can community workers help their clients make a complaint against that police officer?
Again, if someone makes racial slurs or is very aggressive towards someone, the best thing to do is not to get aggressive back, because that doesn't help the situation. Police are there to serve and protect, but we all know there are too many instances where police have gone above and beyond what they're supposed to do in a bad sense. They've been aggressive, they've been physical, they've been abusive. The best thing to do is to immediately make a note of it. So if the client comes in to you, help them write a note, a contemporaneous note. You are allowed to record police's interactions with you. So if the police are interacting with you and you've got a phone, you are actually allowed to record that. Oftentimes they'll tell you that you're not, but you are. So doing that can assist. And then making the complaint as quickly as possible. If you make a complaint as soon or as close to the event as possible, it gives it more weight. So it's more believable if it happened this morning and I immediately go and make a complaint, as opposed to waiting for a week. So it's always about documentation, detail and complaint.
Thanks, Nicholas. I know you've reminded us about a few things that you touched on in your presentation during question time, but if you had to pick just two or three top takeaways from today's webinar, what would they be for the community workers?
I think it's advising your clients what they should expect when police approach them on the street. Too many times, particularly young people, don't know their rights. So the right to not answer questions except your name and address, and the right to not consent to a search. I've had too many people who say, police came up to me and just said they wanted to search my bag, and so I did, and they found drugs, but they had no reason to believe drugs were in there. That's the first one. And the second one is how to make a complaint as well, because too often times we have clients who are not only the subject of charges, but they have been the subject of offences as well, as I'm sure you would have. So ensuring that people know what is the best way to make a complaint, and particularly how to best prepare yourself to allow police to investigate successfully. So all that detail, contemporaneous notes, to allow police to investigate.
Thanks, Nicholas. That's about all we have time for today. So thank you again for your great presentation for the community workers. And thank you to our attendees as well for linking in with us today and asking such useful questions that really would have benefited a lot of people here today. So we're going to close the webinar, and again, if you do have a question that didn't get answered, you can email us at webinars@legalaid.qld.gov.au. Just a reminder that we have recorded today's session. It will be captioned and it will be published on our YouTube channel, which can be found on the Information for Community Workers and Carers page. That's on the Legal Aid Queensland website. We'll email the link around once they're published, so stay on the list and you'll receive all of the webinar links as they are published. Our next webinar will be in April, so keep an eye out when the registration link comes available. That link is on the screen now. And I'm just going to go to a quick survey when I close the webinar. If you do have time today to answer those questions, they would really help us. They have all been designed by Legal Aid ourselves, so we would appreciate those responses because they help decide what topics we'll present on in the future. So thank you again. Enjoy your weekend, everyone.